The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Duncan Webb.
Kia rana, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, I can give you a very recent report on the impact of the Olympics on the New Zealand economy, with Lisa Carrington winning her fourth Olympic medal in the K1200. Mr. Speaker, the economic recovery is
continuing. The member's getting repetitious already.
The economic recovery is continuing to be supported by the export sector. Last week, Statistics New Zealand reported that exports recorded their strongest June month on record, rising by 17% on a year earlier to $6 billion. This came off the back of a record export values for logs and beef, while dairy products and kiwi fruit also experienced strong gains. Mr. Speaker, nevertheless, there are volatile conditions for our exporters and still challenges. The government continues to fund the air freight subsidy scheme to ensure that our exporters can get goods to market in a COVID environment. So far, that scheme has underwritten more than 7,000 flights, carrying over 136,000 tonnes of air freight worth around $10 billion.
Supplementary, what other reports has he seen on the economy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the economic recovery is also being supported by the manufacturing and services sector. The BNZ Business New Zealand Performance and Manufacturing Index is firmly in expansionary territory, rising by 2.1 points to 60.7 in June. Production and new orders were particularly strong at 64.5 and 63.6 respectively. The BNZ Business New Zealand Performance of Services Index rose 2.3 points to 58.6 in June, driven by expansion in sales and new orders. The BNZ economists noted that combined, the PSI and PMI point to an annual GDP for the June 2021 year of around 4%. Mr. Speaker, while our economy is performing strongly, the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic means we cannot be complacent.
What other reports has he seen on how business is faring?
Mr. Speaker, the government's efforts to secure the recovery have been reflected in the performance of small businesses. Xero's small business index for June, which was released last week, hit a record monthly high driven by sales and jobs figures. For the fifth successive month, the index remained above 100, rising 17 points to 127, signalling stronger than average small business activity. Sales across New Zealand jumped 11.7% in June, led by retail trade, manufacturing, construction and hospitality. Jobs growth rose 5%, with the strongest regional growth in Northland and the Waikato. Wage growth also continues to increase, rising 3.7% year-on-year in June, its strongest growth rate since January 2020. Xero said seeing the index reach new heights was an encouraging sign that New Zealand's small business economy was headed in the right direction.
Question number two, Jan Logie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, does he stand by his statement that the employment conditions and pay offer that nurses rejected had been proposed by their own bargaining team? If so, why does he think the nurses' union has stated this isn't true?
Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, in response to the first part of the question, yes. In response to the second part of the question, I'm not responsible for the nurses' organisation's views.
What did he hope to achieve by misrepresenting the union's position outside?
Order. The member can't make allegations as part of a question when they're unsubstantiated like that.
What did the minister hope to achieve by presenting a position that the nurses' union believe is untrue outside of the bargaining process, including through a press release, a press conference, Twitter and a Facebook post?
Mr. Speaker, I did that because when our health sector is under enormous pressure, when the nursing workforce is under extraordinary pressure, with a number of serious issues that
Order.
Need to be addressed, including their pay and the resolution of a long-standing pay equity claim, and the working conditions that many are under because of the pressure the service is under. It is a serious matter when nurses choose to go on strike, and certainly as a consequence of bargaining breaking down, it is important to keep the public informed of what is happening and the background to it.
Supplementary. Is he aware that when he spoke of variable response management, as opposed to the correct term, variance response management. It undermined nurses' confidence in his understanding of the safe staffing program his government proposes to review.
Mr. Speaker, I think the nurses I've all spoken to fully understand that this government takes seriously the commitments it entered into in 2018 in relation to the safe staffing accord and the implementation of care capacity demand management. That scheme has been implemented by 10 DHBs up to the 30th of June this year, partially implemented by 7, and 3 DHBs are way behind on the implementation of it. The DHBs had a deadline of the 30th of June. It is unsatisfactory and unacceptable that that scheme has not been fully implemented across the system. I'm determined to establish why and to fix it. I sought the agreement of the nurses' organisation through the bargaining at their suggestion to set up a way to do that. That has been rejected, but I'm going to proceed to establish why that is the case and to fix it anyway.
Supplementary. Is it true that $10,000 of the $13,000 increase he said nurses would receive was not actually part of the 2021 MECA offer and will be subject to ratification through a separate pay equity vote outside of MECA bargaining?
Mr. Speaker, that is not correct. If I can assist the member to understand the structure of the deal that was developed and that was subsequently voted on but rejected by the nurses most recently, there were two components to it. One was the standard cost of living adjustment that was consistent with the pay guidelines developed by the Public Service Commission earlier this year. There was another element that related to what was effectively an advance on pay equity in view of the fact that concluding the pay equity claim had taken much longer than both the DHBs and the nurses' organisation had anticipated, but it was a way of getting additional income into the nurses' pockets. In any event, that was rejected.
Supplementary. Does he support the DHBs taking the nurses' organisation to the Employment Court over unsafe staffing levels, when nurses have been raising the alarm about ongoing unsafe staffing levels for years?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not responsible for the decisions that the DHBs as employers take in their industrial relations environment, except to say that it has been an issue for some months now that there is uncertainty and a lack of clarity about the commitments that both the DHBs and the nurses' organisation have signed up to in relation to life-preserving services, which is a commitment that the nurses' organisation gives to DHBs when industrial action takes place. In view of that uncertainty and that lack of clarity and the inability to reach agreement with the nurses' organisation prior to the next round of industrial action, the DHBs have decided to get a ruling from the courts on exactly what meeting life-preserving standards means.
Supplementary. Does he agree that the nurses and midwives and healthcare workers are themselves in the best position to judge whether the offer will address their primary concern that staffing levels are dangerously low and putting lives and their well-being at risk?
Mr. Speaker, the workforce that the member refers to are in the best position to determine that. Having determined that, the next step is to find a fix for it, and that is what we're trying to do.
Question number three, Dr. Shane Reddy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, how many of the 30,000 New Zealanders waiting for overdue hospital procedures could have their procedures done if the $486 million in health restructuring was spent on them?
Mr. Speaker, 30,000 New Zealanders are not waiting for overdue hospital procedures. 13,500 people across the whole health system are waiting for treatment, a number which has been exacerbated by the global pandemic. This is why in 2020 the government allocated $282.5 million over 3 years to address the impacts of COVID-19 on waiting lists and also provided an additional $90 million through budget 2021. I can assure the member that this funding is achieving results as waiting times continue to reduce and anyone whose treatment was delayed specifically because of the COVID level four lockdown has now been treated. In relation to the $486 million the member refers to, the government has committed to producing a more equitable health system that better delivers the health services that New Zealanders need. This reform will have a material benefit on waiting lists by producing a more efficient system. There is a cost associated with change, but it is clear that the system must change.
Supplementary. How many of the more than 30,000 waiting for hospital treatment are waiting for cancer treatment and have cancer wait times become worse over the last 4 years under Labor?
Mr Speaker, I again correct the member. There are not 30,000 New Zealanders waiting for treatment. That number is 13,500. A number of those will be for cancer treatments, but what I can also assure the member is that as a result of the investment made in Budget 2020 of $282.5 million and the further investment of $90 million in Budget 2021, those waiting lists are coming down and cancer treatments are improving.
Not supplementary. What does he say to the woman with terminal cancer who was made to wait more than 30 hours in Wellington Regional Hospital's emergency department for a bed, and how many beds would $486 million fund?
Mr Speaker, it is most regrettable that the person to whom the member refers was left waiting for that length of time, as indeed many New Zealanders are experiencing at hospitals that are under extraordinary pressure. The Capital Coast District Health Board is a hospital that is under considerable pressure at the moment, and that is why the Ministry of Health has stood up a task force of senior clinicians to work with those hospitals who are experiencing that pressure to assist them to deal with the pressure that they're under and improve patient flow through the hospital.
Supplementary. Can he guarantee that his health restructure won't further increase the number of New Zealanders who are forced to wait for overdue hospital treatment?
Mr Speaker, the way we have approached the health reform process is exactly to fund additional personnel to manage through the change process so that the business as usual processes of our hospital system are not affected. Our hospitals have been under unusual pressure this year, partly because as a result of COVID last year, the number of infections and winter infections that would ordinarily happen did not happen, and that has led to an unusually high number of infections, particularly respiratory infections and RSV, that has put extraordinary pressure on our hospitals this year. I'm confident that with the work that the Ministry is doing to support hospitals, their clinical leadership and their management, that they are getting through what has been a very difficult winter.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Can the Minister confirm that the increased emphasis on public and primary health care that the health reforms are designed to achieve, among other things, will result in fewer people needing to have more complex care in the future?
Is that Dr. Reti? Are you trying to lose supplementaries for the rest of your team?
Mr Speaker, I can say that that is a primary objective of the health care reforms. And in fact, of the $486 million to fund the transition, a large chunk of that is for commissioning services, including new forms of commissioning primary and community services, just so we start to get a lead on improving that frontline healthcare.
Supplementary. What does he say to the pregnant mother at North Shore Hospital, who was already in her theatre gown from a semi-urgent caesarean section, but was then told that due to pressures on theatres, she would have to drive herself to Waitakere Hospital and to Google how to get there?
Mr Speaker, all I can say to that person is that they have been treated appallingly badly, and that is again most regrettable. But it would have probably been assisted a lot more if the previous government had invested barely $1 billion in 9 years of government, whereas we have invested $5.5 billion in infrastructure because the system has been so badly run down.
Supplemental.
Grant Robertson.
So, in light of that answer, can the Minister confirm that this year's health budget is 45% higher than the last year of the health budget when the National Party were in office?
Mr Speaker, I can say that this government, because Labor governments are public health system governments, has invested considerably more in the 4 years we have been in government than the previous government did, not only operational funding, but capital funding as well. the previous government had 2 years in a row where they invested absolutely nothing in the infrastructure of our health system, and that's why we're having to fix it up.
Supplementary. Can he confirm that the funding for additional support in Vote Health this year is roughly 30% than additional support in Vote Health last year?
I know that member is obsessed about trying to demonstrate there's been a cut in health funding, and there hasn't been. So there has been an increase, yet another increase, in operational health funding for our public health services this year. But the increase this year was not as great as the one last year. But there has been an increase, as this government does when it is in government, significantly increases health spending for the benefit of the people who need it most.
Question number four, Barbara Evans.
Maitaki mata va'atutua. To the Minister of Housing, what recent announcements has she made about funding infrastructure to enable new housing in Porirua?
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Kia ora. Last month, I was pleased to announce the government is investing $136 million into infrastructure in Porirua from the Housing Acceleration Fund, the first drawdown of this fund. This investment will improve sewerage, stormwater and water storage infrastructure and result in capacity for 2,000 additional houses in Porirua. We acknowledge that there is more to do, and this investment is an important milestone in the government's housing plans through our large-scale projects. I'm proud that we're taking action that will enable more houses and improve the surrounding environment.
Maitaki. Supplementary, how will this result in better housing outcomes?
Mr Speaker, upgrading the wastewater infrastructure in Porirua and increasing the capacity for water storage are needed to get new housing consented. Getting this infrastructure in place quickly is vital to getting more houses built and is exactly why we launched the Housing Acceleration Fund. Funding will be used to address land remediation and development work around Cannons Creek. Together, these investments will provide capacity for an additional 2,000 homes on private and government-owned land.
Maitaki. Supplementary, how will this project help create employment and training opportunities?
Mr Speaker, this work will be undertaken by the Te Aranga Alliance with an important focus on creating employment and training opportunities. The Alliance will emphasise hiring and upskilling local workers wherever possible, which will help lead people into sustainable jobs in a booming industry that badly needs more workers. Initial estimates indicate up to 250 jobs could be created alongside opportunities for contractors.
Question number five, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Is he satisfied that the government's investment of taxpayer funds reflects its priorities?
Mr Speaker, yes, the government's policy priorities for the three-year term are continuing to keep New Zealanders safe from COVID-19, accelerating the recovery and rebuild from the impacts of COVID-19, and laying the foundations for the future, including addressing key issues such as climate change, housing affordability and child poverty. The investments we are making are focused on addressing these priorities. At the risk of testing the Speaker's patience, I'll run through just a few examples. We're continuing to keep New Zealanders safe from COVID-19 through the nationwide vaccination program, with nearly 2 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine being administered to New Zealanders, while our investments in the managed isolation facility continue to keep New Zealanders safe from the virus and our economy able to operate with fewer restrictions than nearly any other country. We're accelerating the recovery through our record investments in infrastructure, training record numbers of apprentices.
Order, the members aren't.
Damn it.
To the Minister. Is funding $2.75 million for a meth program run by a mongrel mob member a higher priority than giving money to a successful mental health program?
Mr Speaker, the member knows that the program he's referring to is about getting people off methamphetamine. And the most important thing we can do in that space, in this house, is undertake programs that work. It is not about funding a gang, it is about funding getting people off meth.
Does he consider spending of up to $15 billion on light rail in Auckland a higher priority than the plethora of New Zealand upgrade roading projects now delayed or cancelled?
Mr Speaker, I think that light rail in Auckland is a very important investment in making sure that we have transport moving around our city. But the member doesn't need to see this as a zero-sum game. There's about $6.8 billion of funding there in that programme. Plus another $2 billion that have been added. We are able to do both of those things, Mr Woodhouse.
I just want to say that the member doesn't have a gentle voice, the minister answering the question, but the volume of interjection has got too much. And I think I've told members that I've received in the last sitting block quite a lot of correspondence about noise that's come from one party in particular that has meant that people who are at home have trouble hearing the response. And it's good to have all the premature pleas of not guilty. Michael Woodhouse.
Is $486 million on a new health bureaucracy a higher priority than spending $486 million on frontline services to clear the waiting list backlog?
Oh, Mr Speaker, I'm pleased to say that the government's investing significant resources in both of those things. The first of those is about making sure that we've got a health system that is actually fit for purpose. It's about creating a multi-health authority that will deliver, for the first time probably in New Zealand's health system's history, outcomes that will be more positive for Māori. It's about making sure that wherever you live, you get the services that you deserve. And also, we can deliver on frontline services. The member needs to understand these are not zero-sum games.
To the Minister, do his comments regarding the proposed Northern Pathway this morning indicate he has had a cycleway to Damascus experience and the priority of that project over other harbour crossings is now being reconsidered?
No, Mr Speaker. What it means is that this government is getting on with the job of making sure that the second harbour crossing is underway. Around $50 million is dedicated to that, including completing the business case.
David Seymour.
So, is the government backpedalling on the bike bridge?
Mr Speaker, no. Oh.
Question number six, Glenn Bennett.
My question is to the Minister of Social Development and Employment and reads, what reports has she seen on the number of people receiving the main benefits?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, MSD recently released the benefit statistics for the June quarter. They show main benefit numbers fell 11,193. At the end of the June quarter, there were 354,744 people receiving a main benefit, with 110,790 people receiving a JobSeeker Work Ready benefit. This is well below forecasts, which showed up to 490,000 people could be in receipt of a main benefit due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We are also seeing encouraging signs that the numbers of main benefit continues to trend down over the month of July.
What government investments have impacted these results?
Mr Speaker, when we came into government, we noticed a significant decline had occurred in frontline work-focused case management and took action to ensure we made investments to support more employment-focused activity. This includes investing in 263 new frontline staff in Budget 2019 to help people into work, $150 million in Budget 2020 and $99 million in Budget 2021 invested into employment services and products, and a further $86 million in Budget 2021 to sustain the MSD staff needed to deliver income and case management services. This investment has paid off, with around 31,240 people being placed into employment in the last quarter, the second highest number since records began since 1996.
What other programs have contributed to these results?
Mr Speaker, the government is also working hard to reduce the skills gap between the available jobs and available labour. FlexiWage has seen 4,782 people placed in employment since it was expanded in February, an apprenticeship boost which now has supported 30,031 people into a trade. I've also been encouraged by the results from the Mayor's Task Force for Jobs, which has worked with government to create 1,326 sustainable full-time jobs across regional New Zealand. It is clear that our plan for recovery is creating jobs and supporting New Zealanders back into upskilling, training and work.
Question number seven, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she have confidence the government is doing all it can to keep young people in emergency housing safe? If so, why?
Mr Speaker, when we came into government, we inherited an emergency housing special needs grants and emergency housing process that virtually had no safeguards in place. During our time, we have moved to ensure all that are receiving an emergency housing special needs grant are in active case management. We have housing brokers to support them into housing that is more sustainable, secure and stable than emergency accommodation. We have set up navigators to support those in emergency accommodation with wraparound supports. We have set up a complaints process so MSD can receive and respond to any safety or suitability concerns. We have worked with the Minister, MHUD, and councils to contract spaces in Rotorua to ensure people are appropriately cohorted, and we are going to roll out this particular model to other parts of New Zealand where there are emergency housing hotspots. Mr Speaker, we don't want to see any New Zealanders requiring emergency accommodation, but we inherited a housing crisis, and whilst we have been building houses as quickly as possible, there are still New Zealanders, including some young New Zealanders, requiring emergency housing support. Is there more to do? Yes, and we are committed always to looking at ways to improve the supports that we have in place.
Supplementary. How can she have confidence when a young woman staying in an emergency housing motel said on The Nation, I quote, "I would feel terrified because my room that I'm currently in has been broken into so many times and I had to start putting my table and chair by the sliding and main doors," unquote.
Mr Speaker, no one would deem that acceptable, and I saw that particular report myself and, of course, felt absolute empathy for that young woman. What I will say
Order. The Honourable Louise Upston, she knows how to address ministers. It's not like that. She's been here for a very long time and should know better.
Mr Speaker, this is one of the reasons that we have put a complaints process in place so that people can come back to MSD if there are safety or suitability concerns of the emergency accommodation that they're in. In the last 12 weeks, I think we have received about 40 complaints, but I would encourage anyone that experiences that type of scenario to certainly get in touch with MSD. I would also say that where MSD absolutely accepts that they have a responsibility to work with people to ensure that they're in suitable and safe accommodation, though Motelia has a responsibility to ensure that those rooms are secure as well. And our police also have a role to play a part when there is criminal activity that people are experiencing.
How can she have confidence when a frontline worker said, quote, "We've had a lot of rangatahi who get exposed to sexual trauma, and they haven't come into emergency housing with an addiction, but they often leave with one"?
Mr Speaker, just to clarify, I did see the report. It was a frontline LifeWise worker, and it's important to clarify, not an MSD case manager, and absolutely respect the work that LifeWise is doing with our young people, particularly in the housing space. It is not acceptable, Mr Speaker. That is why we've put a complaints process in place. And where we have social services and organisations like LifeWise who are working directly with vulnerable young people who have those experiences, and we hope that they would feel like the communication is there, that they're able to contact MSD to actually inform them of these situations as well, so we can work together to keep our young people safe.
When will the Gang Intelligence Centre information start to keep people in emergency housing safe, given MSD and police only started working on emergency housing cooperation arrangements in May this year?
Mr Speaker, I reiterate what I've said in the House previously. All of the regional commissioners around the country, and none of the regional commissioners around the country, have indicated that there has been an escalating presence or demand for emergency accommodation grants through MSD in recent months or the time that we have been in place. And so the fact that the minister, or the member, sorry, keeps bringing this up, I think, unfortunately, is more of an attempt to stigmatise those that are in emergency accommodation.
Why did the minister say just last month that, quote, gangs taking up emergency accommodation is not a huge issue, unquote, when a frontline worker said, quote, it's just intimidating for our rangatahi, especially if they're not connected to any gang. Often they leave, and they are then connected to a gang after they leave emergency housing.
Mr Speaker, as I said, I respect the work that LifeWise are doing, and it's important that we continue to work together to keep those in emergency accommodation safe and to improve the system where we can, Mr Speaker.
Question number 8, Shannon Halbert.
Mei taku atupaka wa'a tuatua. Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Building and Construction, what recent reports has the Minister seen regarding building consents?
The Honourable Potter Williams.
Mei taki humaria wa'a tuatua. Mr Speaker, I've seen a report from Statistics New Zealand that shows the number of building consents has broken yet another record, with 44,299 new homes have been consented in the year ended June 2021, another all-time high. This is an increase of 18% from June 2020 year, with 4,310 new dwellings consented in June alone. Mr Speaker, these figures demonstrate just how far we've come in the last year since facing the initial disruptions of COVID-19. We responded to the sector uncertainty by investing in the sector to keep the momentum going to deliver the warm, dry, safe houses that New Zealanders need.
And what do these figures show for Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland?
Mr Speaker, in Auckland, the annual number of new homes consented rose 29% in the June 2021 year, including 51% rise in multi-unit homes. Higher density and modular off-site manufacturing methods are key to helping New Zealand with healthy, modern and affordable homes that we need.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. How is the government supporting the building and construction sector to build on this growth in consents?
Mr Speaker, as a government, we are committed to supporting the sector through the continued investment in trades, training and apprenticeships, our building legislative reform program and improvement to our planning system by repealing and replacing the RMA. We're also ensuring that we have the capacity to meet this increasing demand. Through Construction Skills Action Plan initiatives, more than 9,300 people have taken up the education or employment opportunities in the construction sector since 2018.
Question number 9, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, what is the combined value of properties government housing agencies have purchased since October 2017? And is she satisfied that, in all cases, these purchases have been good value for money?
Mr Speaker, for the purposes of this answer, I've interpreted housing agencies to be the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development and Kāinga Ora. Since October 2017, they have made purchases via the following programs: $377.44 million worth of land via the Land for Housing program, which has contracted or delivered 2,037 new homes with the potential for 6,000 to 7,000 more. $146.4 million worth of Kiwi Build homes, representing 321 homes, but it is important to note that of that $146.4 million, $144.5 million has already been recycled back in. $771 million associated with purchasing approximately 1,186 state houses. Again, it's important to note that this represents just 22% of total state houses delivered over the period, which is significantly lower than the 67% reached under the previous national government. For further context, there are around 85,000 homes sold last calendar year in New Zealand, and of those, Kāinga Ora bought 385. That is 0.45% of the total houses sold.
In the last two financial years, we have also purchased $366.5 million worth of transitional housing, delivering 542 homes. And of course, within our redevelopments of state housing land, we've enabled 1,884 market houses to be built. There is also vacant land purchased under the Public Housing Build Program, as well as other agencies who will purchase property from time to time, such as the Temporary Accommodation Service at MB. In answer to the second part of the question, if the member means the government recognising there's a crisis, actually doing something about it and delivering houses, then yes, I do believe we are getting value for money.
Supplementary. How many houses could have been built with the more than $1 billion government housing agencies have spent buying up public and transitional houses from the private market?
Mr Speaker, the list, the very comprehensive list I just went through to the member, totaled to $1.5 billion that has been spent over that period, that has delivered between 10,086 to 12,970 homes. And if the member is asking, why don't you just build more houses instead of buying them, that is exactly what we have rebuilt our housing provider, Kāinga Ora, to be able to do. Coming off a period of 9 years where they failed to deliver any houses. The agency became a house selling agency. We had to rebuild the capacity, so we're no longer buying in 67% of the houses. In fact, we've got that down into the 20%, and we intend to do even better because we know there is a housing crisis in New Zealand.
Supplementary. Why did the government pay almost double the capital value for the Boulevard Motel in Rotorua at a cost of $8.1 million, that is $270,000 per motel unit?
Mr Speaker, the member is taking a very simplistic analysis to this.
Order!
So the purchase price was $8.17 million, including GST. An independent valuation that was provided in June of this year was $8.5 million. The rateable value was $4.31 million. I would note to the member that residential properties in Rotorua are selling on average 25% RV, as well as a range of other factors. But Mr Speaker, I would also note this is in line with previous purchases of motels, such as the tax Kanini Motel, that had a statutory rating valuation of $1.3 million, but the purchase price was $2.65 million. This was, of course, in December 2016. Eastland Motel, that had a statutory rating value of $910,000, but the purchase cost was $2.1 million. This was in June 2017. The Clansman Motel, a statutory rating valuation of $900,000, but was purchased for $1.84 million. This was also in June of 2017.
Order. I think it's now getting repetitious.
Supplementary question. How many more motels does the government plan to buy this year? And will the due diligence for those purchases include a comparative assessment of how many houses could be built with that cash?
Mr Speaker, we're looking at a range of options in Rotorua where they make good housing sense. I think, as I've just outlined in the answer to the previous supplementary, the previous government, of which the member is a member of that party, certainly went on a bit of a spree as it came up to the 2017 election of buying motels after no action on delivering transitional housing. Where we are buying motels in Rotorua, it's where it makes good housing sense, and where there is indeed potential for redevelopment of that land for longer-term housing prospects. We're not prepared to just deny there is a housing crisis and do nothing about it.
Supplementary question, Mr.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Has the Minister seen any other examples of motels being purchased above their rateable values?
Oh, Mr Speaker, there is indeed a pattern, as I said, in 2017, as we came up to the election year.
Order. I think there are some pretty clear Speaker's rulings about government members not putting up patsies in order to bash the opposition.
Supplementary.
Nicola Willis.
What investigations has she conducted into an allegation by a real estate agent that Kāinga Ora, quote, have approached our company and said that they are happy to pay up to $200,000 over the asking price if the auction falls through, quote, and can the minister categorically guarantee that Kāinga Ora are not pumping up house prices in this way?
Mr Speaker, I heard the same allegation on Talkback Radio as the member is quoting in the House today. I also invited that caller to get in touch with me and to give me the evidence. I have asked officials if there is any substance to the allegation of the Talkback caller. They have said that they can find absolutely no evidence of it. But if that member has any evidence of the Talkback caller, just like with the homeless man allegedly checking in to the MIQ facility, I ask the member to bring that evidence to me. Where is he?
Question number 10, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister, and I wish her well, getting well soon. Does she stand by all her government's policies and statements?
The Honourable Speaker, Grant Robertson. On behalf of the Prime Minister, I thank the Leader of the Opposition for his question. Yes.
How does apologising for immigration policies before she was born help those people separated from their children for over a year by government policy today?
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Prime Minister, the apology that the Prime Minister issued on Sunday was for an egregious use of the state's power over 40 years ago. I would hope that all members of this House would support that approach to try to deal with some of the trauma that has been experienced by those in the communities who were raided in that way. I don't accept the comparison the member's making in his question.
Wouldn't the apology be more sincere if the government did undertake to help those having their families torn apart by contemporary immigration policy, such as those who gathered outside Parliament this afternoon and were meeting in Auckland at exactly the time the apology was being made, but not one of the government's 28 ministers attended?
Mr Speaker, the apology made by the Prime Minister on Sunday was sincere.
Does the government stand by its policy of building a bike bridge across the Waitemata Harbour with a benefit-cost ratio of 0.4, and how will that help solve the very real problem of a shortage of housing?
Mr Speaker, the government stands by its policy of ensuring that we have strong linkages between the North Shore and the Isthmus of Auckland. That is a multimodal solution. It includes making sure that we build a second harbour crossing with a public transport-centric focus. $50 million has been allocated for the business case of that. It also includes making sure that we can have walking and cycling access between North Shore and the Isthmus.
How will debt-to-income ratios on mortgage lending announced today help young people who already cannot afford skyrocketing house prices?
Mr Speaker, those were not announced today. The Governor of the Reserve Bank announced that he was beginning a consultation on that proposal.
How do bans on gay conversion therapy help New Zealanders suffering from people breaking the laws that already exist and the government doesn't enforce, with rising crime on the streets up and down New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, I'm not 100% sure I can draw the exact comparison that the member's doing. I think he's comparing sort of oranges and wombats. He should, I hope, want to be a part of a parliament where we make sure that young people are not put in a position where conversion practices are put upon them. I would hope, and I thought I'd previously heard the member support that legislation.
Supplementary. When will her Minister of Finance answer the significant number of unanswered and 1 week overdue written parliamentary questions about the government's adherence to the Public Finance Act from me?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Minister of Finance informs me those questions have been answered.
Supplementary. Why have the questions not been answered as of 2 o'clock today?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Minister of Finance informs me he signed them off at least 24 to 48 hours ago.
Question number 11, Anna Locke.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Immigration. What announcements has the government made in relation to the RSC scheme for next season's harvest?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, yesterday we announced that the government will work to open up one-way quarantine-free travel to New Zealand from Samoa, Tonga and Vanuatu for RSC workers without having to use the MIQ system. Mr. Speaker, I meet with the leaders of the hort and viticulture sector every fortnight, and I've heard directly the difficulties they have faced as a result of the COVID border closures. We are committed to working with them to ensure they get the required RSC workers for the upcoming harvest. I also know that this will have a positive impact on the Pacific nations. This is also important from a New Zealand perspective, given the challenges that COVID has had on many of our Pacific neighbours.
Supplementary, how has this announcement on RSC been received?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I am aware of reports of growers expressing a strong support for the government's decision around the one-way quarantine-free travel arrangement. Horticulture New Zealand Chief Executive Nadine Tunley has said that this means a huge amount to our growers. Central Otago Mayor Tim Cadogan said the announcement was fantastic news for local fruit growers. And Apple and Pears CEO Alan Pollard said he was really delighted that workers were going to be able to have an opportunity to participate back in the workforce here and return to those much needed funds back to their community. I'd like to thank Alan for his text last night too.
How has the government been working with the sector leaders in the lead up to the RSC announcement?
Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned, Minister O'Connor and I have been meeting with the hort and vit sector leadership on a fortnightly basis to work through the impacts of the closed border on their sectors. Our conversations have been very constructive. In the most recent engagement last week, I discussed our objectives for quarantine-free travel with the Pacific, and they've taken the news well, as I've said. Again, I'd like to thank the hort and vit sector leaders for their engagement. It has not always been easy, but it has always been respectful.
Supplementary question. Thank you. Can the Minister explain why only RSC workers from Samoa, Tonga and Vanuatu are allowed to skip MIQ and not other workers from these countries, given this is the tightest labour market in 40 years?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as you can imagine, one of the key components of us coming to an arrangement with the Pacific around quarantine-free travel is the health and safety of those Pacific nations. We want to stage the ability of bringing people through quarantine-free travel, and being able to start that with RSC workers is a good way to start. We hope that if we can continue along that path, and it is both safe for New Zealand and safe for the Pacific, that we will be able to expand the number of people coming from those three countries and beyond the Pacific. I think the member might want to have a look at the experience of Fiji over the last 2 or 3 months to make sure that we are taking into consideration the safety of the Pacific nations and the health of the Pacific nations when we are making these decisions. The RSC decision is great for our port and vit sector here, but fundamentally we want to make sure our Pacific neighbours are safe as well. And I'm sure members of the opposition would like to do that too.
Question number 12, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. Does she stand by her statement when referring to an interview with Harry Tam about the funding granted to his organisation that, quote, it sounded like a recruitment drive for the gangs, end quote? If so, has she expressed any concern about this to the Prime Minister?
The Honourable Porter Williams.
Meitaki mata awa atuatua. Mr. Speaker, in a rare misstep for that member, he has taken my quote out of context. I was commenting on an interview with Harry Tam where he failed to talk about the harm that's caused to women and children who try to escape gangs, and where he failed to talk about the harm that meth causes to communities. That's what I have expressed to the Prime Minister and to this House, that we can't simply rest our way to success. That's why this government will always be tough on crime and tough on the drivers of crime. The programme that the member refers to gets to people other drug rehabilitation services simply don't reach or can be effective with. This approach isn't new. It's based on a program the National Government developed with a notorious chapter of the mongrel mob.
Does she think it is appropriate to grant $2.75 million to an organisation that is run by a mongrel mob member that she described as being on a recruitment drive for gang membership when gang membership has increased by over 50% under this government?
Mr Speaker, I've been very clear that the lead agency on this program is the Ministry of Health.
Order. Member, resume his seat. Do members on this side want an answer? Well, if they do, they will be quiet. A point of order, Matt Doocy.
A member of the government interjected why Simeon Brown was asking the primary question, and now you're pulling us up? How is that fair?
I had no trouble hearing Simeon Brown because his mic was on and all of us could hear him. The interjections were going right across the microphones into mine and interfering with the answer.
Mr Speaker, I've been really clear that the lead agency on this work is the Ministry of Health, and they are funding a program that fundamentally works. It's been proven to work. We are not funding the gangs. We are funding a program.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her statement, quote, gangs peddle meth, meth destroys our communities, end quote? And if so, was the government wrong to sign off on $2.75 million to an organisation run by a lifetime mongrel mob member?
I stand by my statement. Meth harms our communities. Gangs peddle meth. The Ministry of Health is the lead agency on a program that works. We are funding the program.
Does she trust Harry Tam in light of her statement, quote, I'm sure gangs peddle meth and they do that by recruiting young people, end quote? And if so, does she agree it is in the interests of gangs to keep people addicted to meth?
Mr Speaker, we're talking about wanting to disrupt the harm that gangs do to our communities. They entice, they encourage young people into gangs, and this government is working damn hard to ensure that there are exit points for our young people to get out of the gangs.
Order. Order. Time for oral questions is concluded. Sorry? I apologise. The member does have one. I probably thought I should have taken one away, but I'll keep going.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. What does she say to Police Association President Chris Cahill, who likened this funding to money laundering, saying, quote, police take $2 million of dirty money, as they recently did from the notorious chapter of the mongrel mob?
Questions completed.
Mr Speaker, I have a lot of respect for the work Chris Cahill does with the Police Association, and I agree with him on many topics, including frontline safety improvement programs which keep our police safe, because they do a really difficult job keeping our communities safe. However, I will reiterate, we spent money on a program led by the Ministry of Health. This program supports those people to get out of their addictions on meth. We are funding a program. We are not funding the gangs.
That concludes our questions.